Yes, it is Pet Chat, and I'm joined by Dr. Kimberly Earle today. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thank you. Great to have you.
Thank you.
Now, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, we're going to talk about the some of the hazards of sticks for dogs.
Sticks?
So sticks, like wooden sticks, tree branches, sticks.
Right. And that's a big problem?
It can be, yeah.
Okay, well, that's interesting to know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so sticks, we've had some interesting stick cases in our clinic recently, and I thought I would bring it, you know, public service announcement, bring it to people's attention. We often talk about, you know, the concerns about feeding bones to dogs, but sticks are also a problem. We've recently had a dog who was impaled on a stick. So the owner was playing fetch with a stick. As the stick has landed in the ground, it has stuck into the ground at a 45-degree angle, and the dog, who was running headlong onto it, sort of impaled himself on it. Now, in that particular case, it was sort of more into the shoulder, but my very first golden retriever puppy that was my own dog, her father dog actually impaled his abdomen, did the same thing, ran onto the stick, and he basically opened his whole abdomen up and had everything spilling out. It was pretty messy. So that is one of the problems of sticks. But we do see stick injuries fairly commonly, particularly in and around the mouth, the pharynx area. So we get a lot of dogs that will chew on sticks. And if they're aggressive chewers, they can break off portions of the sticks. You know, sticks over time get quite soft, but they can break off portions of the sticks. And we frequently will find them stuck in between the teeth. So of the, like the roof of the mouth, you'll have a stick stuck in between the carnassial, which are the big teeth, the molar teeth on either side of the mouth. We've had this recently where a dog came in for a tooth root abscess. And when we've anesthetized the dog, there was a great big whomping stick. It was about 7 centimeters long, and the thickness of like your index finger, that was basically jammed in the roof of its mouth. And you wouldn't have known it. We didn't even know it. We hadn't examined that dog in consult, but until it was fully anesthetized, that stick had been there for quite some time. And it basically had eroded the gum, eroded the root of the tooth and the bone. And that dog needed to have both of its big molar teeth extracted due to the damage from this stick. And you can imagine that that would have been pretty uncomfortable. Now, the owners had reported that, you know, about 4 or 5 weeks previously, the dog seemed to be, had a period of time where it was seeming to cough a little bit when it was eating and things like that. But nothing, they didn't really think anything of it. It sort of got over that. But obviously that stick had stuck there and, you know, caused some pretty significant damage. And sometimes we'll get sticks that break off. We can get splinters that will go, you know, puncture into the mouth, go in between the teeth, go down into the tonsillar crypts. In worst case scenarios, people, or they've been reported to have migrating bits of sticks and splinters that will perforate through the throat or get swallowed and then perforate through the intestine. We had a case very, very recently of a dog that had swallowed a long piece of stick that actually ended up being taken out through the stomach wall. It was long enough that it was still in the esophagus, but it had perforated through into the stomach. Not perforated, it had tracked down from the esophagus into the stomach, and it had been diagnosed at our clinic as having a foreign body, which it did, and we took it out through the wall of the stomach, but it was 20 centimeters long. It was huge. And then there's the sticks, you know, dogs getting into the garbage where you've had a kebab, you've had a, you know, dinner party, and there's kebab sticks in there, and the dogs get to rummage through the garbage. And we see this not uncommonly where a dog has ingested a kebab stick that's had some meat still on it or a bit of flavoring. And those are really, really dangerous. They can perforate through the stomach, the intestines, the body wall, into the liver, into the kidneys, into the spleens, things like that. That's a little bit, you know, it's a little bit different than a dog who's using a stick as a toy. But I guess the things that we would want people to highlight is there are stick-safe alternatives that are toys, you know, plastic sticks, rubber sticks. We really like to recommend things like Nylabones and like hard nylon chew toys, things like that. If you have a dog who really wants to chew on something, you know, we would recommend that over bones or sticks. There's Kongs. There's all sorts of toys that, you know, can really be good. Dogs have a desire to chew. It's a very relaxing. It's, you know, they get a good release of endorphins from having a stick, something to chew on and to be really methodically, you know, work at with their mouth. But we want to just be really careful about sticks in particular, because they they can become problematic. So,
can you get infections from them?
Yeah, particularly if they puncture, or if they, you know, the dog's in the mouth, if they are damaging the gingiva, damaging the gums, you can get infections that way. As soon as they go, not just ingesting it, like if a stick can theoretically come through and you know, without any trouble. But as soon as it punctures or scrapes up the inside of your esophagus, then infections are a really big issue. And the trouble with wood is that wood does not show up on x-rays very well, right? Mineral objects, plastic objects, those sorts of things, they'll show up on an x-ray, but wood doesn't show up on an x-ray. And so it can be really, really hard to identify the foreign body. So we often will have to take them to advanced imaging, get an MRI scan done, and they'll be able to see the foreign object that way. But if it's just a stick, a paddle pop stick or a tree branch or something like that, it can be really, really hard to identify. So we often have these mystery illnesses, and it's often, you know, we have to take them to surgery quite often to actually find the source of the problem.
So basically the advice is if you're playing throw and catch with a dog, don't use a stick.
Don't use a stick. And then just be really mindful, even because my dog loves to chew on a stick. I will never throw a stick for her, but she will go into the bush and she will bring a stick out. And I, you know, usually try to like let her have it for 10 or 20 seconds so that she sort of gets over it. And then I take it away and try to redirect her activity somewhere else so that she's not chewing on the stick and not getting splinters in her mouth and things. Yeah.
Jeez. Okay. Well, there you go. I've learned something today. we've got Jim from East Seam on the line. Hi, Jim.
Oh, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. How can we help you?
Well, we have two male ragdoll cats. One's about 13 months old and the other just turned 4, actually.
Yep.
And we recently got the younger one for company for the older one and company for himself, I guess.
Yep.
But we left both of them home for less than 48 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And when we got back, the younger one, the next day, I noticed urine. In his urine, he had some blood.
Blood, sure, yep.
So we took him to the vet, and you know, they took blood samples, and then I came back with a urine sample.
Mm-hmm.
And they said it's probably more from anxiety and stress,
yep.
Because he is a people cat. He's
yep.
everybody's cat.
If
someone walks in, he flops down in front of him and just says, look at me, pet me. So
yes.
I'm wondering, you know, other than taking them to someone's house that we, you know, we feel comfortable with,
yep.
is there anything we can do to reduce the anxiety if we're going to be gone for more than a day?
Sure. And so the problem is often that there's the intercat relations are less good. We do see separation anxiety in cats occasionally, but it's certainly not to the same extent that we see it in dogs. But what we've got is a situation where you've brought a younger cat into a household with an older cat. Presumably the older cat was there longer, and it may be that they are not getting along that well. Now, they might not be openly fighting or hissing at each other, but cats are pretty sensitive. And we always talk about, you know, cat families and whether or not the cats see themselves as two independent entities or whether or not they see themselves as a family. If they're not mutually grooming each other, they're not a family. They don't consider each other, you know, family. They're not bonded that way. And in that case, there is probably some intercat, you know, anxiety going on between them. And the difference is that when you're home, there's a bit of an intermediary there where they sort of go, okay, well, that doesn't matter. I don't need to get along with you because I've got the people here and they can act as a bit of a buffer and they can keep me company and things like that. But when you go away and it's just the two cats with each other, there's probably a little bit less of that mellowing sort of influence of having people in the house. So that's the most common thing that we see with cats. I'm not saying that your young cat couldn't just be having separation anxiety, but it's much more common that we've got an intercat issue here. And so we want to do all the standard things, making sure that we're optimizing the environment, making sure that we've got a plethora of litter boxes, so at least 3 litter boxes in that house, and they really do need to be in differing locations so that there's no way that the older cat can potentially block access to the younger cat from all of the litter boxes, because that's a very stressful thing for cats. And cats can be really passive aggressive. I know I've said it before. They may not be showing any open aggression, but there might be one cat standing at the end of the hallway. And in order for the other cat to access the litter box, he's got to get past that cat down the hallway to the laundry room, which is often where the litter boxes are. And the older cat or the younger cat, whoever it is, might be standing there just going, nah, dare you to try to pass me, you know, just there's not necessarily any outward signs of aggression, but it can be pretty stressful. And in particular, if you've got the younger cat is most likely to be the one who is bearing the brunt of that anxiety, because he's sort of younger. He's not been there as long. So right. Litter boxes is the key, first key thing. Food dishes, food resources and water dishes, lots of vertical placement of different perching spots, beds and perching spots. So cats really do live in a three-dimensional world. So getting them up off the floor, giving them shelves or cat perches or different things that they can be in, that can really extend their range as such, or their environment, by having different levels and things that are up high as well, so that maybe the younger cat just needs to get up and away from the, you know, from the older cat. There are certainly things like pheromone treatments that are really helpful in these situations. So look for products like Feliway Friends. There's a couple different Feliway products, but the Feliway Friends can help with intercat relations and trying to help associate, you know, each other with not being threatening, I guess, towards each other. And then it might be that you have to... Sorry?
Or do we get that from a pet shop or from the vet?
Either or, probably. Pet shops will have them. Vets, your vet will probably have them. They can certainly access them for you online. There's lots of different places that you can get them as well. And, you know, I would recommend the diffuser, sort of the plug into the wall diffuser. Depending on how big your house is, you might need a couple of those. There are some really great new foods that are available that are anxiety-reducing foods. So depending on what your vet said, they may have recommended that your cat go on to a strictly urinary diet, but there are some that are designed to help urinary health as well as have some calming effects, and that can be really good. And then there's a few other products. So I would talk to your vet, you know, about we want to probably tackle this from a multimodal standpoint: environment, food and supplements that we can use. Hopefully your cat doesn't need actual pharmaceuticals, but lots of them do, so that might be, you know, where we need to go. So have a chat with your vet and see, you know, what are the different strategies that you can use to try to reduce the anxiety for your young cat.
Okay. Yeah, thanks very much. They do groom each other.
Do they? Okay.
And the older cat, if the younger cat comes over to the food bowl, older cat walks away.
Okay. So it may be that we've got, even then, there are still, I mean, a lot of those strategies are still good, because we want to make sure that the cats feel safe when you're not there. So, you know, even some of those strategies, the calming food is still worthwhile having. The Feliway, you might just get the other Feliway rather than the Feliway Friends, the standard Feliway, which is just a general anxiety reliever. If they are mutually grooming, then that's hopefully takes that one thing out of the picture then for you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Good luck, Jim.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Jim. And we have Danny from Curry Curry on the line. Thanks for holding, Danny. How can we help you?
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, thanks.
That's good. I have, at home, I've got three dash hounds.
Okay.
My partner's always had dash hounds. His big girls had, multiple litters, 3 litters.
Mm-hmm.
And they kept one of their pups.
Okay.
From the litter, and that's fine. Unfortunately, lost to the father and one of his other daughters a couple of years ago due to back injuries and snake bites. Anyway, long story short is I've gone ahead and bought a little dash hound myself.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, this little monster, she's a monster, she has decided that she's still suckling at the age of 2. Now, the young one, Lucy, has never had a pup in her life. That's Kira's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And she's suckling to the point that Lucy's producing milk. And if once she's finished with Lucy, she goes back to Kira. And then Kira is now got boobs as long as her feet. We don't know what to do. She's just an absolute little monster.
So what's the name of the dog that's doing the suckling?
Gizmo.
Gizmo. And so Gizmo is unrelated to Kira or the other one?
Lucy.
Lucy.
completely unrelated.
And has come into the house as a puppy when one of those other dogs had a litter of puppies that they were nursing?
No. There was no puppies around.
Oh, no, okay.
There was no puppies around. It was Kira and Lucy.
Yep.
I bought Gizmo because Kira had pups moons ago.
Okay.
Anyways, and Lucy was her pup.
Yep.
Anyways, so there was no little pups running around.
Okay.
I bought Gizmo at what standard age I would pick her up and brought her home and she was fine. And then all of a sudden we're like, what's going on here? Was that probably started about 6 months. And she even a little bit longer and she just will not stop. She'll stop for a little bit.
Yeah.
But our problem is like...
And they're letting her.
Yeah, like they just, she just suckles. Like she doesn't let them go.
Okay.
And Kira's, and we've sat there, my partner and I sat there and actually put compresses on Kira because we're worried that she will get mastitis and squeeze her teeth so that she's not going to get sick or anything inflammatory.
Mm.
She's not as bad on Lucy, but worse on Kira.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, usually when we see an adult dog who's got suckling behavior, and sometimes it's even just that they're suckling on blankets and things like that. Usually they're doing that as a bit of a self. There's an anxiety cause underlying it, and they're doing it as a self-soothing sort of mechanism. It's often seen in dogs that are hand-reared or removed from their dam too early. So it would be interesting to know whether or not Gizmo, you know, maybe the mother, they had to be pulled from the mother early or, you know, hand-reared or something like that, because we often see these problems in dogs that are removed from their mother early.
I have seen that myself. My mum's got a spoodle,
yep.
And she quite often will jump on a blanket and suckle it.
Mm.
But that's the only other dog I've seen, so I understand what you're saying there.
I guess the things, and so you've said that, so the females are actually producing milk, are they?
Yeah,
are they entire? Yes. They're still entire? They're not desexed females?
They're still entire.
Entire, yeah, okay. I mean, their ability to produce milk may actually diminish if they were to be desexed, which might be worthwhile for it, because probably we're getting some, like if they're actually producing milk for Gizmo, then probably there's like it's rewarding that behavior, right? Usually the females would just like snap at them and tell them to, you know, bug off, like you're totally inappropriate. But I would consider maybe talking to a behavior vet about that for Gizmo. It might be that we need some baseline anti-anxiety medications to try to help. And then I would definitely be discouraging him from Gizmo's a male or female?
Female.
Another female. Yeah. Okay. I would definitely be discouraging, you know, not letting her continue to practice that behavior. I definitely would consider desexing the others if you're not still breeding from them, so that there's less likelihood that they can produce milk. And definitely, I would be concerned about mastitis and secondary infections, like even just glandular tissue infections and cellulitis and things happening. It's a pretty unusual sort of scenario and is probably a little bit complex. But I would tackle it both from addressing the female dogs who are producing milk and allowing the suckling, trying to get them to reduce that behavior, as well as Gizmo, get some underlying baseline anxiety medication, speaking with a behavior vet about it, probably maybe if it's possible to delve into her history a little bit more and try to work out where this might be coming from, if there's an underlying reason for an attachment disorder almost, like where she's like overly attached to these other dogs, and then just trying to prevent the behavior. Because I think what she needs is a break from, it's probably become a habit to a certain degree. Sort of separating her and preventing her from having access to the other dogs when you're not, directly supervising her is probably a good place to start as well. But I think she may need some anxiety meds to help her cope with that. So good luck with that. It sounds very unusual.
It's very unusual. I've never seen it before. Mm. I've asked her breeder, never heard of it before. Bus stop of other people, like dash hounds, never heard of it before. I'm like, righto. I've had done rescue when I was in Sydney and I've never seen it in kittens or anything like this before. I'm like, you're driving me nuts, kid. You're driving me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would go and have a chat with your vet and see what we can do in terms of starting some baseline anxiety meds as a starting point for her.
Yeah. Good luck with that, Danny. Let us know how you go. We've got Michael from Merriweather on the line.
Hi, Michael. What can we do for you?
We've got a five-year-old whippet who had a bout of colitis, confirmed by the vet by x-rays and clinically, and she lost a considerable amount of weight. And we attributed it to something in her diet, possibly chicken or possibly wheat, so we've excluded that, gone on to novel proteins.
Novel protein, yep.
So she's just eating fish and no grains and now beef, so a mix of beef and kibble with just fish and no grains. And her tummy's settled down largely and she's weight stabilised. She had about 3 weeks tapering dose of prednisone, but now she seems a bit flat and B, her skin is still a bit flaky on her hind quarters. And her poo was normal for a little while and now it's not normal again. But her tummy's not blown up. It was very distended and x-rays showed lots of gas in the colon, even in the small bowel. So the vet did say she might need, of course, you know, low dose of prednisone long term, but to me that's just treating the symptoms rather than the cause. Have you got any clues what we could do?
Yeah, well, I mean, you're obviously already on a novel protein diet or working towards, you know, trying to work out if there's a food trigger. And that can take quite a long time. We're, you know, often 8 to 10 weeks to really give the gut a chance to rest and to decide that it's not inflamed anymore. We need to have enough time for the cells that are lining the intestine to sort of do a full changeover, right? So from the ones that were inflamed to a new set. Colitis, in terms of colitis being in the large bowel, we often have to add a good amount of fiber to the diet for these guys. So you're doing that, cooked pumpkin or psyllium or something like that?
Psyllium and probiotics.
Yep,
liberally.
Great. Yep, good. And then I guess 5-year-old, she's not an old dog, but we certainly can in some dogs, you know, see vitamin deficiencies if they've had problems long term. I don't know if your vet has done vitamin B testing.
Nutripet,
the gel. Okay. So you've got her on B vitamins and things. So that's good.
Intensive care nurse. This dog's
she's
intensive care.
She's getting it. Yeah. So you know, it's a tricky thing. I think some of these really refractory cases, we end up needing to take biopsies of the gut to really work out if we've got, you know, an inflammatory bowel disease or if we've actually got a low-grade lymphoma or something happening there, which is not super common in young dogs, but it can happen. But I would push through a little bit longer. I think, you know, the novel protein, or I've had really good luck with some of the hydrolyzed protein, hypoallergenic diets. So, you know, because if the novel protein diet isn't working or was working but seems to now not be working, then sometimes a hydrolyzed protein diet can be worthwhile trying as well. And, you know, just try not to get frustrated. I think some of these dogs will take, you know, a good, you know, 6 to 8 weeks to really get over that hump. So, you know, don't lose heart. Hopefully she's, you know, and liberal use of Procol, and I'm sure your vet has put you on to Procol and paste as well, particularly when the stool is, you know, not ideal if it's sloppy and things like that. So
we even contemplated a fecal transplant.
Transplant.
Well, that's the last straw, I imagine.
Yeah, not necessarily, but I mean, we certainly do. We've done, you know, the fecal transplants via enema, and that can be quite successful. But you've got to get, you know, you've got to have another dog that's got really good, nice, robust, healthy feces, and we usually do some fecal testing, fecal PCR testing, make sure we're not going to accidentally seed something up into the dog who's already compromised. So
It did show Clostridium. But that's not necessarily
pathogenic. That's right. No. Yeah, not necessarily pathogenic. So it can be, but it's not always. So dogs are a little bit different to humans. So just having the organisms there doesn't necessarily mean we have a toxic load or a toxic problem happening. So
All right. Okay. And it's common, this colitis. It's not rare, is it?
It's pretty common. So, I mean, basic acute colitis is really common. With stress colitis in dogs, we see it all the time. Most dogs will get over it within sort of 3 to 5 days, right. particularly if we can find out what the underlying sort of cause, you know, has triggered it. But where we're talking about a proper inflammatory bowel, you know, colitis, it can be a little bit trickier and more frustrating. So it sounds like your dog is leaning towards that sort of more complex.
She did come perfectly good, so maybe we'll try a different diet again.
Yeah, yeah, that might be worthwhile.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks very much.
Good luck, Michael.
Bye. This is Pet Chat on 2NURFM, and we've got Brenda from Hawk's Nest on the line. Hi, Brenda. How can we help you?
Hi. We have a 7-year-old Great Dane. She's just been diagnosed with cancer. And we're very upset.
Yeah.
And we don't know how to make her, happier.
Yeah, comfortable. Okay. So the notes that we've got here say that she's been diagnosed with lymphoma. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, okay.
About a week ago, she was given about 6 weeks to live.
Mm-hmm.
And she's making this funny, she's breathing, but she inhales, and when she exhales, like a grunt. We don't know if that's getting very close.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, lymphoma is one of these cancers that's really common in dogs. Without sort of aggressive chemotherapy and things like that, the usual life expectancy is about 6 weeks. Hopefully your vet has put her on some palliative prednisolone at high doses. Have we done that?
Yeah. Given the tablet, she takes 5 tablets a day.
Yep.
But that wasn't to prolong it. I think it was just to make her more comfortable.
Absolutely. That's right. And so prednisolone can have sometimes it has a really dramatic improvement effect, but it's very short lived. But it can, if we've got these big swollen lymph nodes, it can actually reduce the size of them in the short term quite significantly. And the big issue we have with lymphoma is that sometimes the lymph nodes get so large that it can start to impede breathing or swallowing, things like that. Yeah. It's also a cancer that causes a lot of fever. And fever in dogs, if you can imagine yourself, when you get a fever, you get quite achy. You don't really feel like eating. So prednisolone can reduce fever, and therefore we can start to feel a bit better. And it can often stimulate their appetite and keep them eating and things like that.
She's eating quite well, but she's drinking a lot of water.
Yeah.
And she lays on the tiles, so we put the fan on.
Yeah.
But it's just, we don't know how to make her feel better.
How to make her feel better, yeah. And depending on what kind of staging and things has been done, you know, lymphoma can go into the chest and into the lungs. And so I guess the thing that I would always say is that if she, you know, appears to be having difficulty breathing, or if she's constantly out of breath, you know, if she looks like a dog who's been running around, but really she's just been lying on the floor, or if she's really starting to cough a lot, then we may need to have a chat with your vet about, you know, quality of life, because there's nothing worse. Nobody wants, you know, their dog to be highly anxious or distressed because they can't get a full deep breath.
We don't know how to tell when that's the time. Will we know?
Usually, but, you know, I guess the thing that I would say is if you're not sure, take a video with your phone, send it in to your vet, ask them to have a look at it. Because sometimes they're just breathing heavy because they might be, you know, feeling a little bit tired or, you know, feverish. But your vet should be able to tell if there's actually, you know, a difficulty breathing if we think that the dog is in distress.
We picked up a lump just under her throat. So that's when we took it to the vet. Then we found out she had one on the other side and underneath her back leg.
Big leg.
And now she's got them
everywhere.
One either side of her ribs.
Yes. Yep. So, so definitely those. That's right. Those are the lymph nodes, and they get quite large, and they can cause quite a lot of, not pain. They're not usually painful, but you know they can get quite big, and they can cause functional difficulty. So, you know, I guess the last thing I would say is, it's probably always better to make that decision for euthanasia one day early, more than one day late. You know, I think if you're questioning it, give her a nice, peaceful, respectful goodbye with everybody who loves her around her, and you won't go wrong that way. Okay. So sorry to hear it, Brenda.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye. Oh, that's a shame.
It's horrid, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. Hopefully, the dog's not in too much pain.
Yeah.
Now, look, we'll just quickly, we're going to go to our website, 2NURFM.com.au, and check out our pets of the week. We've got Baxter and Maeve. We're going to start with Baxter.
It's a little Baxter, not so little Baxter, a 5.5-year-old bull mastiff. He's a white dog looking for a calm, loving home where he can stay close to his people. He is a people dog. He likes to be in the house. He's well toilet trained, doesn't bark. He is friendly with other dogs, but they do feel like he would be better as an only dog in the home. He is looking for a house that doesn't have children. So a quieter household where he can enjoy human companionship, be inside with his people. That might be the perfect opportunity for you. And then little Maeve is our gorgeous little tabby cat. She's a 2-year-old female who loves human interaction. She's very still young and playful, enjoys chasing toys, climbing, sitting in the sun in the windowsill. She's quite an adventurous spirit. They said she's a confident cat who would suit most homes. She hasn't met young kids yet, but they do believe she would do just fine as long as they were moderately gentle. Has lived with lots of other cats, and that would be fine. Hasn't met any other dogs yet, but she would also be okay as an only pet as well. So nice young cat, not a kitten, but still a nice young cat with plenty of years of life in her. So if you're looking for a nice young cat, Maeve might be the kitty for you.
And she's also in Broadmeadow at the moment. You can check our website for details on that if you'd like to have a look at her. Well, that's it for the day. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome.
It's been great to have you.
Thanks.
And we'll catch up again next week for Pet Chat on 2NURFM.